my big message about life is that sometimes it's good to see life as a puzzle to solve instead of a war to wage, and that we should, instead of getting furious, we should get curious.
Welcome to Backseat Driver, the podcast hosted by two practicing psychotherapists, where we boil down years of experience with clients young and old to teach you how to do the what to do to improve your life and relationships.
I'm Mark Yamada, clinical psychologist in Seattle.
And I'm Nikki Bennett, licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake City.
Well, AJ, welcome, and thank you so much for being here with us today. It's so great to have you on our show.
I'm a fan of the show, so honored to be here.
We're intrigued by the idea that you can change the way you think by changing behavior. You know, as therapists in the mental health profession, you mostly find people talking about changing their thoughts, which then leads to a change in actions, which then leads to a change in emotion. But there's this other side to changing, that it can start with changing your behavior first. And I would consider you to have a PhD in life. So tell us your concept about AJ, the human guinea pig, and how that came about.
Yeah, well, I love that you said that, and I definitely want to get to that. But I am a writer, and most of my books involve me trying something out for a year, maybe longer, and seeing how it changes me for the better, how it changes me for the worse, and then trying to take away some lessons. So I have tried to become the healthiest person alive and tried to eat better and sleep better and even go to the bathroom in a healthier way, which we don't have to get into. And then I did one where I tried to follow all the rules of the Bible, from the Ten Commandments right on down to growing a huge beard and not wearing clothes made of mixed fabrics. And my most recent one was where I went around the world and tried to thank 1,000 people who had any, even the smallest role in making my morning cup of coffee. And as you say, all of them involved me changing from the outside in. So doing something, and then that eventually changed the way I thought. There's a great quote. I wish I had come up with it, but I think it's by the founder of Habitat for Humanity. He said, "It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting."
Wow. I love that.
That's great. Oh my goodness. Yeah. How did you come up with these ideas? The experiments and go, hey, that's a great idea.
Well, one thing I always remind myself and others is that, I do come up with a lot of ideas, and 95 to 99% of them suck. So it's a numbers game. You have, in any creative endeavor, you really have to just generate tons of ideas because one of those, hopefully, will be a winner. But you should know, that Mozart, Beethoven, any Picasso, they did a lot of terrible work in addition to their genius work. So I guess that's one answer. And the other answer is just looking around my life and trying to be inspired. So, for instance, my first book was about my quest to learn everything in the world by reading the encyclopedia, when they still had encyclopedias, from A to Z. And I got the idea from my dad, who actually, when I was a kid, he started to read the encyclopedia, but he gave up after the middle of the letter B, like around boomerang, because he had a life and he had better things to do. But I said, you know what, I'm going to try to finish what he began and remove that dark period of history from our family. So just always being aware of what's around you to get inspiration.
You've got a lot of grit and tenacity, because I know that I can sign up for something like that, but honestly, I admittedly wouldn't have made it past A. Is that something that's just you were born with, or you've had to develop?
Well, yeah, I use a bunch of tricks to increase my grit. I mean, one of them is just announcing my projects right at the start, saying, I am going to read the encyclopedia, or I'm going to live by all the rules of the Bible, and spreading it, putting it on Facebook, telling all my friends, because then if I don't follow through, there's a level of humiliation. So that I find, you know, the accountability, that is just one way that I do. I mean, honestly, I'm also a writer, so I have often a book contract. And so if I don't finish it, I don't get paid. So there's a little motivation as well. But yeah, I think grit is something that you can, learn and increase, because I think we're all born with different levels of it.
So is there one experiment that you've done that's been more meaningful to you than others, or that stands out more than others?
I would say all of them, I've taken away something. I would say the most recent one about gratitude has really had a profound effect on me, especially during this COVID crisis, where it's really hard to be thankful because so much that's obviously going wrong. But I mean, just to back up about that project, the idea is that we all have two sides to our personality, the Larry David side and the Mr. Rogers side. So the sort of the negative, pessimistic side, and then the Mr. Rogers side, which is the hopeful, grateful, optimistic side. And I think I was born with a very strong Larry David side. And I like his show, but it's just not a fun mindset to be in, to always find the negative. So this project was in part an attempt to turn that around and notice the hundreds of things that go right every day that we totally take for granted. And that's why I went around and I thanked in person or by phone, you know, everyone who had a tiny part of my cup of coffee. So the barista, I went to South America and I thanked the farmer, but that's just the start. There was logo designer, there was truck drivers, there was, and you can take it wide. I mean, the truck couldn't have done its job without the road. So the people who put asphalt on the road, and you begin to realize all the hundreds of things that do go right. And that, to me, it's still a struggle every day. It's a wrestling match between my dark and light side, but really just concentrating on what we take for granted and has been a tremendous help, especially during COVID.
I loved your concept of, I think you said you thanked over 1,000 people. Is that right? For one cup of coffee?
That's right. Yeah. As I say, I took it wide. I mean, I could have gone to 1,000,000, like, honestly, because you realize that everything is connected. As I say in the book, it doesn't take a village to make a cup of coffee. It takes the world. And it was an interesting experience, because I would call people, and some of them were kind of freaked out. Like, you know, I would call to try to thank the guy who made the ladder that's used in my cafe to get the coffee. And they'd be like, is this a pyramid scheme? Are you trying to sell me something? I'm like, no, I just want to. But I would say the majority were actually very, very grateful to be thanked. I remember I called the woman who did pest control for the warehouse where my coffee was stored. And I said, I know this is kind of strange, but I just want to thank you for keeping the insects out of my coffee. And she said, that is kind of strange, but thank you. I don't get a lot of appreciation in my job. So she described it as an anti-crank phone call, which I think is a nice concept. We should all place more anti-crank phone calls.
Uh-huh. I love the concept of this interconnectedness, because it feels right now like the world is so divisive in so many ways. But, you know, we've all seen the science behind gratitude and how it changes our behaviors, our thoughts, our actions, our state of happiness. I have to say, this morning I was checking out your latest, short video on this project, and I felt happier just listening to it, thinking about all the people that have had to come together this morning to make this phone call happen. And not just the four of us, but all the techies and, you know,
everything. How about that? Yeah, how about that for an infection or a pandemic, that gratitude can spread this interconnectedness and just make us happier people, expand our minds. And wouldn't that be a great thing to have spread?
No, oh, I love both what both of you said. Yeah, I think first of all, it makes me happy that it made you happy. And this phone call could not have happened with, you know, there are miners in Chile who went and got the copper that is used in my microphone. You know, there's hundreds, thousands of people who made this possible, including Nikki, your husband, Ben, who is an old friend of mine and I'm a hero of mine, because you had mentioned interconnectedness. Another one of my projects was about the global family tree, which was this idea that we are all related. All humans are cousins. And there are people now helping to show us that in an actual family tree using DNA and using the internet. So that, like you say, we're all interconnected, whether it's through helping us make coffee or the fact that you and I are probably, you know, 18th cousins, and Mark, you know, you and I are maybe 19th cousins, who knows, but I love the idea of reminding ourselves we are one big family, and shouldn't be us versus them. We have such an us versus them mentality right now, and it's quite harmful.
I love that. Ben actually came home when he first started working in genealogy research and family history and said, I have great news. We're 8th cousins. That's too close. Too close.
That's hilarious. Well, that was my wife too. We actually showed up as DNA about 6 cousins. And I thought it was exciting. I was like, this will spice up our marriage. And she was like, please don't. Please don't talk about that.
So, and don't tell anybody else, please.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Tell us about the 6 degrees of gratitude.
This is just the idea that everything we do is connected to everything else. So, for instance, when I went down to Colombia, to a small town in a mountain town where they grew the coffee, and I thanked the farmers, they're small family farmers. And at first they were a little confused as to what I was doing, but eventually I think they came around and they said, well, you know, we couldn't do our job without, I mean, they didn't say 6, it could be with 10, 100 other people. There's the machine that takes the skin off of the coffee fruit. And that machine is made in Brazil. So they're all the people who made that machine. They have a pickup truck that was made partly in the United States. So everyone relies on dozens of other people, and those dozens of other people rely on dozens of other people. So it's like, maybe your listeners are too young, but it's like that, that ad for, I guess, hair dye back in the 80s. We told 2 friends and they told 2 friends and they told 2 friends, and it's just this exponential number of people.
I love it. Could you tell our listeners, I love the story about how this project actually came about, sitting around your dinner table. I'd love it if you'd share that.
Of course. I had known that gratitude is important. I mean, you read the science and it is so good for you in so many ways, mentally and physically. So it's tied to even recovering from illness more quickly. There are studies about how, you know, it helps fight depression. And so I knew intellectually it was a huge deal, but how do I do it? So I tried to start this ritual before dinners, where I would say out loud with my kids and wife, I would say, you know, I'd like to thank the farmer who grew these tomatoes and the cashier who sold me these tomatoes at the grocery. And my son, who was about 11 at the time, said, that's fine, Dad, you know, but it's also kind of lame because those people aren't here. They can't hear you. So if you really cared, you would go and thank them in person. And I thought, that isn't actually a pretty good idea for a book. So he earned his supper that night. And I went and I decided to focus on coffee just because, to make it simple. And I did go around and try to thank 1,000 people. And what I loved about it is gratitude. Keeping a gratitude journal is great. I do a version of that. But this was two-way gratitude, so where you're actually expressing the gratitude to a person. And that, I think, is it's got so many benefits because it makes them happy, it makes them feel appreciated, and that, in turn, that is sort of a virtuous cycle, so you feel even better when you express gratitude to the person.
Love that. How have your projects impacted your family? Particularly, I have to ask about the year of living biblically and stoning an adulterer. Like, we can't not bring that up in this phone call.
or the story, AJ, about how your wife went and sat in every chair in the house.
Oh, well, yes. I was very proud of her. Very annoyed, but very proud.
That was just hilarious.
Yeah, just to quickly talk about both of those. I mean, my overall... The projects have their good and bad on effects on my family. So sometimes they like what comes out. Sometimes it drives them crazy. And the Bible one was particularly challenging for my wife. So, you know, I had this huge beard because Leviticus says you cannot shave the corners of your beard. I didn't know where the corners were. As Nikki mentioned, the Old Testament says you have to stone adulterers, so I felt I should at least try, and I did use very small stones, like pebble-sized stones, to stone an adulterer here in New York, but he was not very happy. It was actually not a pleasant experience for either of us, so I have stopped.
You got a 2-for-1, right? Because it was an eye for an eye on top of stoning an adulterer, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so I was in Central Park here in New York where I live, and I was really getting into the project. So I had a robe, I was wearing sandals, the huge beard, and this man came up to me and said, "What's going on? Why are you dressed like that?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to follow all the rules of the Bible, from the Ten Commandments to stoning adulterers." And he said, "Well, you know, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And I said, "That would be fantastic. Thank you for the offer." So I took out this handful of stones or pebbles that I had been carrying around. And he was very aggressive and grabbed them out of my hand and threw them at my face. So Nikki, as you said, an eye for an eye, also in the Bible, I figured I can toss one back at him. So that's how I checked that off the list. And then Mark, you had asked, you had mentioned this other thing that drove my wife crazy, which was... in the Old Testament, it says that you should not touch women during their time of month because they are impure. And if you take Leviticus really literally, it says that if a woman sits in a seat while she's menstruating, then the seat becomes impure. And my wife found that offensive. You know, she's a modern feminist woman. And so she, while menstruating, sat in every seat in our apartment. And I was forced to stand for most of the year, which later turned out, when I did a book on health, it turns out standing is healthier than sitting. So in that sense, she did me a favor.
Fantastic.
Oh, dear. What did your children think as they watched you do this?
Well, they were... you know, they have varying opinions. They were really too young to understand the Bible one, but the most recent one, the gratitude one, they were a little disappointed that I chose coffee because that doesn't help them. They wanted me to do thank everyone involved in s'mores so that we could have s'mores around the house all the time. But again, yeah, they are they have mixed reactions. I think my obsession with gratitude has rubbed off a little. So that's nice. I remember when we were at a couple of years ago while I was doing this, we were at my mom's house, and And one of my sons, you know, asked, you know, Grandma, can you pass the strawberries? And she passed them, and he said, oh, thank you, Grandma. And also thank you, great grandma and great grandpa, for having you. And thank you, great, great, great grandma. And it went on like that for a while. And I thought it was a lovely point. Yeah, we wouldn't exist without our parents.
So cool.
Yeah.
Tell us what one of your hardest experiments was and how you stuck with it when you wanted to quit, because I'm sure you've had those moments just like all of us.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Every day, usually, if it's a good experiment, it's going to be challenging. So, when I was doing the health book, which was the idea was, you know, I was pretty out of shape. I was not, like when we get sick a lot, and I wasn't traditionally fat. I was more what they call skinny fat. So it looked like sort of the snake that swallowed the goat kind of body. but it was very challenging because I was overwhelmed. There are so many things, so many pieces of advice that you have to do to try to stay healthy. So it was like a 24-hour a day job. It was very stressful. It was very unhealthily stressful to try to be maximally healthy. Because, you know, you got to exercise, you got to meditate, you have to pet dogs because there's evidence that that is lowers your blood pressure and various. And I didn't have a dog at the time, so I would go to the dog park and try to pet other people's dogs. And that was received with mixed reactions. So it was very strong. But like we talked about right up front, the idea of changing your behavior to change your mind. So I would wake up kind of in despair most mornings that this project is just too big. I'm not a doctor. I'm talking to doctors and health experts, but maybe this just is over my head. But what I would do is I would pretend to be optimistic. I would act as if I were optimistic and confident. So I would call, you know, the top doctor and request an interview. I would email my publisher and say, so when this book comes out, let's have a big publishing party and we can serve kale martinis and, you know, it'll be wonderful. So even though I wasn't feeling it at all, but after a couple of hours of acting as if I were confident, it kind of sunk in. It kind of tricked my mind and I would become more confident. And that's how, despite wanting to give up many times or just feeling despair, I would be able to change it by acting as if I were not despairing, as if like this is, I'm going to do this. And eventually I did.
I love that. I actually read that in a book by Jewel, the singer-songwriter.
Oh.
She wrote a book called Never Broken. That's a fantastic book. And in one of the chapters, she talks about being agoraphobic, where she didn't even dare leave her car. And she said, I knew that my thoughts were leading to my experience, but I couldn't even determine what my thoughts were. And so I thought, what are your hands doing? And she said, I wasn't leaving my car unless it was to go to the bathroom or to steal something. And she said those behaviors were sending a message to my brain that I couldn't do life. I couldn't handle it. So I decided to use my hands to do the things that I would do if I felt the way I wanted to feel until I did. And I read that. Isn't that fantastic? It's just what you said. I woke up the next morning feeling anxious like I do 95% of the time. And normally I'll just open kind of one eye at a time and go, okay, how bad is it today? Can I just meditate a little longer? Can I maybe sleep a little bit longer? Can I do a body relaxation? But this day I was like, okay, if I felt the way I wanted to feel, I'd probably open my eyes and put a smile on my face and hop out of bed and make the bed and open the blinds. And I felt very robotic going through this morning miserably. But by lunchtime, I felt good. I really did.
Wow. I love that story. I mean, it reminds me of a book I read called, it was something like Make Your Bed. And it was the idea was that these tiny little actions really are crucial because they get your momentum going. And I'm a big fan of those like micro goals. You know, for instance, just if I do try to get on the treadmill a lot because I'm, you know, I don't play sports. So I walk briskly. I'm not a big runner. But to convince myself to get on the treadmill, it's all about micro goals, you know, just saying, I'm just going to put on my sneakers and then we'll see what happens. You know, I'm just going to go on for maybe a minute and we'll see what happens. But eventually it leads to you being on the treadmill for, you know, 20 minutes. And I love what Jewel said.
Yeah, I love that. I'm curious, your year of living healthy, how did that impact your health?
Well, one of the big sort of meta lessons was, as I said, I was super stressed out from trying to be healthy all the time. And stress is one of the worst things for your health. One of the takeaways was, you know, there are several pillars of health, and the ones that get the most attention are diet and exercise, which are important, but stress and sleep are equally important. Having a close social network, so keeping in touch with friends and family, that is hugely important. And so I found, you know, if I'm so obsessed with finding the right, you know, stalk of asparagus with the most antioxidants, you know, if that is preventing me from hanging out with my friends, which I was allowed to do at the time because it was pre-COVID, then that's not healthy. You know, you have to have balance. So that was one, and it was kind of a relieving lesson that being overly obsessed, there's even a technical term called orthorexia. Being overly obsessed with your health is not healthy. So that was one sort of meta takeaway. But the other is I do try to, I'm not a natural athlete, as I say, but I have found that having a treadmill desk has made my life a lot better because I don't mind walking and I'm watching Netflix or reading my emails. And that's the thing about exercise that really resonated with me, is that, you know, you got to do exercise that you like. So if you don't like, if you really hate going to the gym, then just don't go to the gym. Find another, you know, gardening, building stone walls, or, you know, there's hundreds of ways to get physical exercise. So you got to find one that you really like, or you're never going to do it.
And it's often really just a simple thing too. I think people can sometimes feel that it has to be something grand and otherwise it doesn't have meaning, but it's really something that we can do just within the reach of our everyday lives. Use that, like you said, just, you know, just start walking somewhere rather than driving if it's, you know, within a reasonable distance, and just start standing rather than sitting all the time, that we can use these little things and build those into our lives to not make it overly complicated.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, yeah, walking meetings instead of sitting down with someone, I find that is very useful. You know, let's just take a quick walk and talk through. So like you said, it can be little things.
Love that. So what's next for you? What's next on your immersion bucket list?
I am right now, I'm working, writing a book called The Puzzler, and it's about my quest to solve all the hardest kinds of puzzles, which I love. I love puzzles. So we're talking crosswords and jigsaw and riddles, but also, you know, the puzzle of the meaning of life. So I'm trying to take it wide, and I've been having a blast. I went with my family when we were still allowed to travel. I went to Spain and represented the United States in the International Jigsaw Puzzle Championship. And we We're terrible. We came in second to last, but we did beat Portugal. So we always have that. But I love puzzles, and my sort of my my big message about life is that sometimes it's good to see life as a puzzle to solve instead of a war to wage, and that we should, instead of getting furious, we should get curious. So even something like, you know, the culture wars, if I'm talking to someone, you know, I'm on the liberal side. So if I'm talking to a Trump supporter, instead of trying to debate them and win the war of words, I try to approach it like a puzzle. Like, why do they feel the way they do? Why do I feel the way I do? What can we do about it? How can we change minds? Is there a middle ground? That kind of puzzle. So I'm a big fan of puzzle as a metaphor for life, but also just fun puzzles. And there are going to be a lot of puzzles in the book.
I love it. We need you at our house, AJ. We're on our second jigsaw. The first one was 1,000 pieces, and we lasted about 30 minutes. Our second one is a 500 piece, and it's been sitting there since Thanksgiving with just not even quite the full frame on the outside. Too much ADD in this house.
That is funny. Yeah, I'm a fan. I mean, jigsaws are very, a lot of people talk about the meditative. They're like, you know, they're calming and meditative. So, which I do feel, you know, it's sort of a balance between frustration and meditation.
I love that. So I just hope that so many of our listeners are inspired by your ability to just jump all in, your enthusiasm for life. Mark, I've been thinking as we prepared for this call so much about me going to India. So AJ, just a short little background. Ooh. About 12 years ago, I was seeing Mark for anxiety, and I was also seeing John McConnell, my life coach at the time. And he invited me to go to India to go trekking in the Himalayas and to kind of discover my vision and my passion and my purpose. And for me, it was like, I wanted to just face all these demons and overcome anxiety. And Mark, you were such an integral part of this experience. Explain to our listeners and to AJ your concept of logic and reason over emotion and running toward the roar.
Mm. Yeah, there's this wonderful story that has been passed down through the generations and called Running Towards the Roar. And the story goes that in a pride of lions, the male lions, they do look big and scary, and they can certainly sound that way and act that way, but they often really don't expend any more energy than they have to. And so what the lions do is they'll sit there, the male lions, and they'll roar. And the antelope, so you got to kind of imagine, you know, being an antelope, when you hear that, then the antelopes start running away from the roar. And you can imagine that as you're running away from the roar, you're actually thinking and feeling that you're getting safer and that you've gotten away and that all is well. Not knowing that as you're doing that, you're actually running towards the ambush where the female lions are waiting for you. And the real solution is to run towards the roar. And often in our human lives, we get conflicted between our emotions and our feelings and our knowledge, intellect, and reasoning. You can imagine them kind of like two operating systems, that one is our default starting place, but it can be one that can take your reasoning mind hostage, where emotion and feelings can override knowledge and intellect. A funny story about this, I remember I was working with a person several years ago, and we were talking about this concept of using our knowledge to override emotion or just instinct or even things like just the desire to be gratified. In this conjunction with talking about running towards the roar, and she smiled at me, and you can imagine, you know, sitting across from me, and she motioned with her hands and said, you know, oh yes, it's like when I have this battle with cheesecake. And she held up one hand and motioned with the other hand as though she was using a fork and said, I know I should not be doing this. And so this whole idea that we are creatures that have feelings and emotions, but as we want to improve ourselves and become more effective, we must actually face our emotions, or not let our emotions override knowledge and good reasoning. And that becomes a quest that I think affects all of us throughout the duration of our lives, of not letting our feelings do all the decision making. And so as Nikki went through her trek in the Himalayas, she really faced some really tough stuff. And Nikki, I'm reminded of the story of the bridge. You talk about, share with our listeners the experience of crossing the bridge.
So, AJ, when we got to India, first off, getting on the plane was huge for me. So I get there and Ben had said,
just a question, how long ago was this?
This was 12 years ago. And gotcha. At the time I had, my kids were 3 and 8 and we were living up in Seattle, and I didn't even like to leave my children to go St. Mark. So you can imagine getting on, you know, this airplane and going to India was huge. Wow. And Ben had said, now there's a couple things, cause he traveled there a lot. And he said, don't let anybody take your luggage and don't ride in a tuk-tuk. So what's the first thing we do? We get off the plane, these men come up and grab our suitcases, and I'm watching them going, this can't be good. And they stick our luggage in the back of the car and they say $100, or no, it was $20. And I said, I don't have cash, I don't have cash. And Robert, one of my friends with us, said, here's $100.
Wow.
So we were taken right away. But from there, we took a 13-hour bus ride and a 5-hour Jeep ride to get to the heart of the Himalayas where we were going to do our hiking. And about 3 days hike in, we were supposed to cross this bridge to go see Babaji, this holy man, and ask him the meaning of life. And the villagers came through and said, the bridge has been washed out by a monsoon, we can't go. And I was sort of, you know, thrilled about that because I loved Kati, this little village we were in. Well, then the porters came back and said, no, we can go. We're going to throw down some 2x8s and just stick them across. So you can imagine this footbridge. It's about 50 feet above the river.
Oh my goodness.
And it's got 3 supporting beams, and one is completely broken and one is bowing down, and then one's firm and has a handrail. And there would be, you know, 3 slats close together, and then you'd have 5 feet and you'd have another slat, and then you'd have 2 feet and another slat. It was very dilapidated.
Oh my goodness.
So we got there.
Even listening.
You should be. So we get there, and I had been doing this work with Mark so long. I was sort of like you, AJ. I just jumped all in. I was like, I'm going for it. I didn't even think about it. I got on the bridge and I, you know, hustled. I mean, I was doing a sprint across the other side of the bridge, and my coach is going, slow down, slow down. And I get to the other side of the bridge and turn around and see what I've just come across. And that's when I had an epic meltdown. Like, there were tears, there was drama. My coach was like, what have I done? How could I recover from this? Because I knew I had to come back.
Oh, so, yeah.
You know, we spent 3 days, or not even that. I guess we spent a night or two there. And coming back, I was able to look at it from a standpoint of, okay, what is the likelihood of this happening, of me falling off the bridge? You know, there's porters that are heavier than I am, carrying packs heavier than I am. And then what's the consequence? So likelihood times consequence. Consequences, I would be dead. But looking at the likelihood of it, I was willing to take that risk and do it in a centered way so that I had a completely different experience. of crossing the bridge the second time.
Wow, what a story. That's amazing. And what is the meaning of life? Did he tell you?
he said, basically, do what makes you happy. And we each got to ask him one question. And I said, Babaji, should I have another baby? Because at this point, I think I had had 3 miscarriages and I had gone through all this infertility and I was waiting for him to tell me what to do. And he looked at me and he said, if you want another baby, then yes. And if you don't, then no.
All right. Solid advice.
Yeah. So that was it. So there's your new challenge, AJ, running toward the roar. Doing everything you're afraid of.
I love that story. I love that. That is great.
Any advice you have for our listeners? I just think you're such an inspiration.
Oh, well, thank you. I am a big fan of experimenting with your life and trying new things. And because, you know, neuroscientists will talk about how we create these ruts in our brain when we do the same thing over and over. And so I'm a big fan of trying things out and seeing what works. And it doesn't have to be running across a dilapidated bridge in the Himalayas. It doesn't have to be following all the rules of the Bible. It can be small things. It could be, you know, trying a new toothpaste every month. It could be going to work a different way. It could be, you know, reading a book that's totally outside of your interests. So that is the way I try to live. And I think it keeps my life more interesting and opens to new ideas. So that would be, if I had one suggestion, it would be that. It would be experiment more and embrace curiosity.
I love that. You know, for all of our listeners out there, go and do good things. Be thoughtful. Be more appreciative of others and make gratitude a bigger part of your life. And I know it will change your life. Between that and, like you said, AJ, doing something different, I can attest the fact that it really does change your life.
Oh, absolutely. And I love this one thing that you had mentioned, AJ, about use gratitude as a spark to action. And we invite and encourage all of our listeners out there that you can use that. Use gratitude. Just start looking on how to be grateful in small ways. And that can become the spark that will guide you to more actions. And just by doing that, you're going to find that you'll be paying attention to the little things.
Absolutely. AJ, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here today. I've heard about you for years from Ben, and I'm so excited I finally got to meet you.
Well, thank you both. I had a delightful time, and of course, very grateful to you and to Ben and to Steve Wozniak for co-inventing the Apple computer that made this happen, and et cetera, et cetera.
Excellent. How would our listeners get in touch with you or find out more about the work you're doing?
Oh, I'm on Twitter at AJ Jacobs, or Facebook, or my website is ajjacobs.com. So I'd love to hear from listeners about their experiences.
And if you haven't already, check out his book, Thanks a Thousand, A Gratitude Journey.
Yeah, take a look. You'll love it. And that's it for another Backseat Driver. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it with a friend.
We'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to rate and review our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.